that our speaker for this evening is Hank J. from Palmdale, California.
Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Hank.
I'm very glad to be here, and I thank the committee for asking me to be here, and I've met some people here, but, you know, I know quite a few people in the audience, and it's funny, you know, it's always strange now. It's not the way it used to be, because now when I walk in a room and I know somebody or they know me, I don't have to flee the scene. I can stay right here, you know. That's kind of nice. And, you know, I know that I'm an alcoholic, and they read the traditions and chapter 5 and everything. I really do know that I'm an alcoholic, and I know that I'll never be anything else but an alcoholic till I die, you know. But I don't have to drink now. But, you know, I've often thought, well, what I'll do is so science can have a chance to study an alcoholic, I'm going to leave all myself to science when I die. My liver and all that stuff, you know. And I know that when they drop my brain down in that alcohol, in that jar, it's going to say, ah. But in the meantime, I'm going to try to stay away from that stuff. I drank for 30 years. I went into a bar when I was 18 years old, and they served me. And in California, you're supposed to be 21, and they served me without asking for my ID or anything. I passed for 21 years old. And immediately I became a man, and that's what I wanted to be, a man. I was anxious to become one. And the mark of a man is that he can buy a drink over a bar without being asked how old he is. And I was comfortable in that place. I went back all the time. They had a jukebox over in the corner. I could play the jukebox just as good as the rest of the guys. Yeah. I could sit at the bar and look at myself in the mirror and get better looking after each drink. And I just went back there every opportunity I had from then on. And I met my wife in a bar. You know, where else do you meet girls? And we got married, and we moved out to a little town outside of Los Angeles, West Covina, and bought a little house out there. The payments were $56 a month. That included taxes and interest and the whole shot, you know. Nothing down, naturally. You know, when those payments would come due on the first of the month, I'd have a hell of a time coming up with the payment. Because, you see, I use my money to drink with. And I figured, well, I'll skip the payment this month. I'll double up next month. And so next month would come along, $112. How am I going to ever get that amount of money? You know, somehow I wouldn't pay somebody else, and I'd make the payment. And, you know, we almost lost that house several times. We finally had to sell it before we lost it. We moved in with my father for free. If anybody would have asked me, Hank, what is your problem? I would have said, money. Money is my problem. I don't know how I got involved in this job I'm in. It doesn't pay enough, you know. If she would just help me by going to work, you know. No, instead, it turned out she was pregnant after we got out there. And she had a little daughter by a previous marriage. And you know, I didn't start saving for that baby until about a week before it was due. You know, I just couldn't come up with that hospital bill, so I went to the beneficial finance company. And I borrowed money from the beneficial finance company to pay for the doctor bill and the hospital expenses. And you know, when my son finally turned 25 years old, and I finally got on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I finally got beneficial paid off. Now, it seemed there's always a crisis in my life. Every time I'd almost get them paid off, I'd have to, you know, something would happen, I'd have to consolidate my bills again. And sometimes I had Pacific Finance going, too. Sometimes a bank loan also, and all three at the same time. And I'd total up my bills and interest at the end of the year for income tax purposes, you know, and I was always amazed. My God, what I'm paying all this interest and making all these payments, you know. What am I buying for this? You know, they don't finance $100 cars, I'll tell you that. I just could not imagine what I was paying all that interest for. And I finally figured it out after I got sober. A couple of years, I finally figured it out. What I did was finance 30 years of drinking. Every time I took a drink, I paid an extra 10 cents or so to beneficial finance for interest. And that's another freedom that I have now. So my drunkologue is the most boring story you've ever heard in your life. Maybe the next speaker or the speakers will be a little more exciting. I hear exciting stories from the podium. Guys, you know, they go into a bar and they punch everybody out in the bar, and the cops come and they punch the cops out. They get drug off the jail and they walk into the jail and they see the, you know, they walk over to the bunk they want and they pull the guy out of the bunk and punch him out too. You know, that's drinking. Let's face it. I mean, that is exciting drinking. I heard a guy drive through a tunnel 70 miles an hour and then make a U-turn. Yeah. All kinds of exciting stuff like that. You know, all I ever did is just sat around and drank. I watched a lot of TV and played phonograph records and read books, you know, Reader's Digest, condensed versions, you know, nothing heavy. And I just kind of, I meant to do a lot of that stuff. I just never got around to it. You know, I used to think about it, you know, doing all that exciting stuff. But, among my other, one of my other faults is procrastination. I heard a young speaker from Alatine speak in Palm Springs a few years ago, and his mother always used to tell him, you know, why do you procrastinate so much? And he says, well, what does that mean? And she says, why don't you look it up in the dictionary? And he says, oh, I will later. You know, and I identify with that kid, and that's me, you know. One of these days, when I get $1,000, when this next summer or sometime, you know, I'm going to do something. And I postponed living for 30 years. And when I finally came out of my stupor, why, God, I just didn't know what the hell to do. You know, everything I've learned in my entire life other than working has been involved. Booze has been involved, you know. Dancing, romancing, you know, you name it, anything. Booze has been involved. I either drank before, during, or after. And when I sobered up, my God, it's tough to learn all over again what you're supposed to do, you know, only this time without anything to drink. And I just drank all the time. That's all. Just drank all the time. And that's my story, 30 years of drinking. Jesus. I'm ashamed of it, but that's it. To create excitement, my wife used to kick me out of the house. She'd come home and she'd find me intoxicated and she'd just get angry and kick me out. She'd say, you know, leave. I never thought to argue with her, you know. She'd say, leave. I left. That's all. No, never thought. I was just so unworthy. I never argued. Wait a minute, I own part of this house too. No, I just left, that's all. But I never moved very far away from home, just down the street a little ways. And then I'd work my way back in. And I was in and out, back and forth, and she divorced me 3 times. And finally, the last time I wound up in Hermosa Beach, California, a little garage house, and it was a half a block from the water. And I just thought it was a terrific little place because I was going to go down there and run along the beach every morning and really get in shape. I hear that the beach was down there. I couldn't prove it by me. I rented this place, and it was really just kind of a one-room place. It was like 12 by 15 room, and I bought a turntable and 10 speakers from a friend of mine. And I had speakers in all four corners, behind the drapes, behind the couch, in the bathroom, in the kitchen. You name it, there was a speaker there. And kind of a typical day for me was to wake up 10 o'clock in the morning. And I'm already an hour late to work. My God, I'd throw my clothes on real fast and shave and get in that car and weave in and out of traffic and break all the traffic laws. And I'd get to work because, you know, I had to get there fast because I was running late. And I knew I was going to get fired because, you see, I should have worked yesterday. And I had left all these papers all over my desk, and God, I had some papers in my desk drawer. Some of them were really old, you know. They were too old to turn in. If I turned them in, I'd be fired for holding them so long. And if I didn't turn them in, I was going to be fired, too. And I knew it was all going to happen today. I was sure of it. And I heard this term after I got sober, you know, the feeling of impending doom. Well, that's the feeling I had every morning when I drove to work. I knew I was going to be fired. And I got there and I checked my desk out and everything the same as yesterday. Whew, man, you know. And I'd go get some coffee and I'd come back to my desk and shuffle papers and try to look interested and make excuses to my customers. They'd want to know why they hadn't got what they ordered. And I'd make excuses like, well, you know, the class of help we get nowadays. You can't depend on it. Or I'd use the computer. That's a good one, you know. They're still using the computer today. I'm proud to say I was one of the originators of that excuse. I used it even before we had a computer. The computer's been down for the last 6 days, you know. And then I'd look up at the clock. It'd be a respectable time to go to lunch, about 11:45. I'd go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And they sold martinis over there, and I like martinis. And during the lunch hour, they sold double martinis for $1. The regular martinis were 75 cents. But during the lunch hour, a double for $1, I'd say, you know, you're going to have two anyhow. Who ever heard of having one martini? You're going to have two anyhow, so you might as well order the dollar one, and you'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money bad. And I'd order that dollar martini, and I'd get to sipping on that thing, and I'd kind of compare my drink against the guy sitting next to me. He'd have a 75-cent one. And I'd say to myself, who the hell do they think they're kidding around here? This is no double. It's a little bit larger than the 75-cent one. If it were really a double, they'd be charging more money for it. You know, they can't kid me. I've been around, you know. And so I'd say, you know, so I better have another one. And then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and say, I forgot to tell you, I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd get in my car, and I'd head towards the beach, and I'd stop and get the cheapest bottle of vodka I could get, whatever was on sale that day at Thrifty Drug, and just the cheapest thing I could get. And I'd get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon, and I'm an extra neat drunk. I'd get home and I'd hang up my clothes real carefully so that the creases fall properly, you know, and put my shoes away and everything, and hang up my shirt and all that stuff, and put my pajamas on. And then I'd sit on the edge of the bed in my pajamas. It'd be like 2:30 in the afternoon. I'd untap that cheap vodka and take a big, big jolt out of it. Several swallows, you know, just a, jeez, well, you've done it again today. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why in the hell don't you do something about it? All you do is just sit around and you don't take care of your business, you know. At least you should go out and get a second job anyhow. You're so far in debt, you know. You know, at least you can get a second job and you can catch up financially, you know. And then I'd say, wait a minute. You don't need to get a second job. You're in sales. And you know, if you're in sales, you can make practically anything you amount of money you want to, within reason, of course. But heck, if I apply myself, I can really make some money. God, that's right. Yeah. Starting tomorrow morning, it's all going to be different. I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork until 9. And when that phone starts ringing tomorrow morning, I'm going to be ready to do business. And it's all going to be different, you know. And I'm going to, from here on out, the rest of this year, I'm going to devote all my time to making money, you know. And I'm not even going to drink. The rest of this year, I won't drink. Maybe I'll go to a New Year's Eve party and have a few drinks. But you know, I'm going to devote all my time to working. And I'm going to play catch-up, and it's going to, you know, it's going to be great. I'm going to get out of debt. A lot of guys have done that. I can spend 1 year out of my life playing catch-up. A lot of people have done stuff like that. You know. Geez, I don't know about you folks, but when I have those terrific ideas like that, I have room to celebrate, so I have another drink. And, you know, then I get to thinking, you know, God, you know, if you triple your income, which you'll do, you know, if you triple your income, you're going to be out of debt in no time. Then what are you going to do with all this money coming in? Well, one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a white Lincoln Continental car. And I'm going to drive it up to that house where she still lives. And on the way up there, I'll stop at the Hallmark card shop, and I'll buy a beautiful card, you know, one of these big ones, you know, no 25-center, at least a dollar card, you know, and it'll have beautiful sentimental poetry on it. And over on the left-hand side, I'll write, "Thanks for all the good years, H." You know, not Henry or Hank, just H. And I'll drive that car up at midnight, for instance, so I can make sure and get the proper parking place right in front of that house. And I'll drive it up there quietly, you know. And I'll get a gold-plated key for that car. And I'll put the gold-plated key in with the card in the envelope. And I'll just pull that car up real quietly in the middle of the night right in front of the house. And then I'll tiptoe up on the porch and I'll put that envelope down the mail chute, and then I'll split. And the next morning she'll get up and go through her routine, and she'll get her mail, you know, and naturally she'll take the biggest envelope first, and she'll open it up, and that key will fall. I wonder what that key is, she'll say. And then she'll look at that card, you know. She'll read that beautiful poetry, the sentimental kind, you know. Tears will just roll down her cheeks. It'll just be so damn sad, so excruciatingly beautiful, it'll just make her cry. And then she'll look over on the left-hand side and she'll, "Thanks for all the good years, H." You know. And then she'll look out in front of the house and she'll see that white Lincoln Continental out there, you know. Brand new, shiny, gorgeous car out there, you know. And she'll, the key and that card and... And she'll put it all together that that's her automobile out there. Then she won't think I'm so bad. Then she'll be sorry, by God. And I don't know about you guys, but I get a big charge out of giving those expensive gifts like that. So I have another drink. Then I look at, you know, I look up at the clock and it's 10:45. My God, where has this day gone? I cannot believe how late it is. What's happened here? It can't be that late, you know. And then I realize the liquor store closes in a few minutes. And I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas and I'd run 3 blocks to the liquor store. And that's when I first started jogging, about that time. I had to get there before that place closed, you know. And get the guy just as he was putting the light out, you know. Bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands there in the local area. I wouldn't want them to think I was cheap there in the neighborhood, you know. And then I could walk back to my shack with peace and comfort and security for the rest of the night. And it hadn't been such a bad day after all. I've accomplished quite a bit. I've got my whole future ironed out, and I know what's going to happen starting tomorrow, and by God, it's all right, you know. And I'd have dinner, like a cold hot dog out of the icebox. And I'd sit on the edge of the bed a little more. And, you know, I'd put an old, you know, I always used to play these old records, you know, and I'd put on an old Billy Eckstein record, you know, some record like Who can I turn to? Some ballad. You know, I love those ballads. And then I was all set, you know, and somewhere in there I'd pass out. And I'd wake up the next morning, and God, it'd be 10 o'clock. And I'm already an hour late to work, and geez, I'd throw my clothes on real fast and shave, and I'd get in that car, and I'd weave in and out and break the traffic rules, and I knew by the time I got there I was going to be fired because, you see, I should have worked yesterday, and I left all these papers, and the boss were to look in my desk drawer, some of those papers were months old. They were too old to turn in. If I turned them out, I'd get fired. I knew it was all going to happen today, you know. Yes. And, I knew it was going to happen, and I'd get to work, and I'd check my desk. Everything's the same as yesterday. Man, I'd go get a cup of coffee and come back to my desk and shuffle papers and try to look interested. Make excuses to my customers why they hadn't got what they ordered. And I'd blame it on the class of help or the computers or whatever I could think of. And then at a respectable time, I'd go to lunch at the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I was. And I'd go over there and make my big decision of the day over there, you know, whether to have the dollar one or the 75 cent. And then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one. Then I'd call the office and tell them, I got to tell you, I'm going to a lot of calls. Take messages, I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd get in my car and head towards the beach and stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka they had, you know. And I'd get home and hang up my clothes and put my pajamas on, sit on the edge of the bed and take a big, big drink out of this cheap vodka. And I'd put an old 78 on the turntable, something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" And then I'd get to talking to myself, you know, and I'd say, "Well, done it again today. You're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why don't you do something about it? You just sit around. You never, you know." Then I'd have this bright idea, you know. I don't need to get a second job. I'm in set. And starting tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. Get down to that office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple of hours. And when that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And it's all going to be different starting tomorrow. And I'm not even going to drink for the rest of this year. Maybe I'll have a few drinks on New Year's Eve or something. Yeah. It's all going to be different. You know, I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. Towards the end of the month, the boss would want to know. He'd say, "Are you in sales here?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I'm in sales." He'd say, "Well, how about making a sale?" And I'd say, "Don't worry about a thing. I'm a fast finisher." And I was, because I was running scared. You know, I was afraid I'd lose my job, and I'd work around the clock. And I always made my quota, this company. And every month, every year, and if you, the company I work for, if you make your quota, why, they give you a plaque with your name on it. And it says for outstanding salesmanship and product knowledge and being the type of representative that we want to represent this company and all that good stuff on a big plaque. You know, for 8 drunken years in a row, I want a plaque. And then I got sober. And for the next 8 years, I didn't win a plaque. Yeah, I lost my motivation. After I got sober, I wasn't afraid anymore. And so I didn't, you know, I figured, geez, just showing up on time. You know, they ought to give you a raise for just getting, you know. And I thought they ought to give me a raise just for showing up on time. It's, you know, I found out it's what you do after you get to work is what they give you the raise for. But I had that all mixed up. I thought because you get sober, they should reward you, for God's sake. And look at the sacrifices we're making, right? And you know, after 2 years of sobriety, I walked in that office, and the guy told me, "You're fired." I said, "Fired? You've got to be kidding. I've been with this company 10 years now. I got an outstanding sales record." "You know, you can't." "Well, not lately, you don't," he said. And I says, "Well, yeah, but, you know, this is ridiculous." And I says, "I want to go see the regional manager." And I went to see him in his big office in Century City. And I went in there, and I used to say that I took my fifth step with him. But what I actually did is I sniveled and cried to him. You know, I said, geez, I've been with this company 10 years now. And God, you know, I've got an outstanding sales record. I just don't understand this guy. You know, 2 years ago, I completely changed my life. I stopped drinking. My wife and I are trying to make it together. And, you know, I'm trying to pay my bills on time and kids and everything, you know, and trying to become a citizen in the community again. And now this guy wants to fire me. I just can't understand it. And so regional manager said, well, that's all very interesting, and I congratulate you on quitting drinking, and I hope you and your wife, you know, make it together, and kids and everything. But he says, I can't interfere. They don't want you to work in that office. I can't do anything about that. He says, but the only thing I can do for you, he says, is I'll put you on paid leave of absence for a short time. You claim to be a salesman. Go sell yourself to another branch office. We've got 80 of them. And that's what I did. And I'm still with that firm, by the way. But what happened to me is what happens to a lot of people in AA. I've seen it happen to a lot of people. You know, after I finally got on the program, I got so interested in AA that I just had tunnel vision. That's all I could see is AA. I couldn't talk to anybody unless they were a member of AA. And I had nothing to say with anyone else, and it was everything else out there was unreal, and I was just kind of spiritual, and I just kind of sailed up into the blue, you know. In fact, my sponsor pointed out that some of us get so heavenly, you know, that we just become of no earthly good to anybody. And that's what happened to me. And he also pointed out that in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it states in there that it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but you should keep your feet firmly planted on the ground. And there's work to be done, and to take these steps and all that good stuff. You know? And that's what I've been trying to do ever since. But I got ahead of my story. About that time, I got a call from my ex-wife, and she said, come and get your drunken son. He's just like you are. And it seemed that he had turned 16, and he was going to high school, and he got his driver's license and went right out and got a reckless driving ticket. And he was just getting in a lot of trouble, nothing really major, but just a lot of stuff that she was having trouble coping with, and the kid was just really going bad. And nothing, like I say, just nickel and dime stuff, but just enough to drive her crazy. So he went to a party one night, and he came home drunk. And he threw up on the carpet or something. And that was it. That was the last straw. And so she called me and said, come and get your drunken son. He's just like you are. And so she said, so I had to do it, right? You can't, I couldn't argue with her. So I just went and got my son. And he didn't want to come and live with me. I didn't want him to come and live with me. But she said, so I had to do it. You know? And so, you know, in fact, he used to come and visit me occasionally. Before then, and on a weekend, he spent a weekend with me, and I never knew what to say to him. You know, if I wasn't drinking, I just couldn't think anything to say, and I'd say, well, to myself, you know, what would you say if you were a regular father, you know? And I tended to lecture him then. I'd say, you know, with your smarts, you know, you should be getting all A's in school. I'm really surprised at your grades. Your personality, you should be student body president, for God's sake. And with your physique, at least you should be playing football anyhow. You know, all the things that I kind of wish I would have done when I was in school. But if I were drinking, which was most of the time, I just tended to slobber all over him. You know? And I'd tell him how much I loved him, you know, And I'd tell him stuff like, you know, all the trouble your mother and I have had over the years has nothing to do with you. You know, we love you. You know? And you were a love child, I used to tell him. You know, you were no accident. You were a love child. He used to sit there and just cringe. He couldn't stand to listen to that crap, you know. But I couldn't stop once I got started, you know. I just could not stop, and I wanted to, but I couldn't. And he would just sit there and squirm, and he'd finally escape somehow, you know. And then the next morning, I'd be ashamed of myself, you know. Not that I was drunk, I was ashamed that I told my son I loved him. And I couldn't even look him in the eye. And I'd drive him home and dump him off. So he didn't want to come and live with me. In fact, after one of those weekends, he came home and asked his mother, he says, "You've divorced him. Is there any kind of legal action I can take?" So he came and lived with me. And it's a funny thing. That was the start of a beautiful relationship that we've got going to this day. And we had a resentment in common, you know. That's enough to build a friendship. A lot of meetings are started that way with a resentment, you know, but we had this resentment in common. You know, Mom had kicked us both out, you know. We had that to build from, and we've got a relationship going to this day. So about that time, my wife came down to visit her little boy, you know, and she checked him out one Sunday afternoon, and one thing led to another. We got to talking, you know how that is, we realized, you know, we seemed to be miserable people, but we seemed to be more miserable apart than we were together, and why don't we try this thing one more time, you know? Why are we treating each other this way, you know? God, you know, when we got married, we had some plans, and what's happened here, you know? Our daughter had already split, and now our son was getting ready to graduate high school, he'd probably go into service or whatever, you know? All we had was each other. Why are we treating each other like this? And let's sell that house, pay off our bills, and we'll all move in here, you know, in this one room, yeah. Pay off our bills. And she said, "I won't fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you." And I should have been suspicious right then and there, but I wasn't, because, see, all the years I was married to that woman, she never drank. Once in a while, we'd go to a party or something. She'd have a drink, and she'd, you know, gag on it, you know. I'd try to get a big tall glass and put a lot of 7-Up in. "Here, drink this, you know, have a few drinks, loosen up, you know, have some fun. We're here to have fun. This is a party, you know. Have a few of these." And she could never drink successfully, you know. She always got sick. And so when she said, "I won't fight you on your drinking, in fact, I'll join you," I just let that one go over my head. Little did I know that during that 2 or 3 year period we were apart, she had started drinking. She had crossed over into that, you know, that so-called invisible line into alcoholism. In fact, she claims that she was an alcoholic before she ever took a drink, you know, just like dynamite waiting to be lit. Now myself, I feel that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I drank myself into alcoholism, you know. And I drank successfully for a lot of years, you know. I had a lot of fun drinking, you know. But it's just like penicillin. I took penicillin several times. And the last time I took penicillin, I had a sore throat, and the doctor gave me a shot of that stuff, and I hardly got home until I was just... God, I just went nuts. I started, broke out in the hives and everything. I wound up in the hospital for 8 days. I almost died. You know, all of a sudden I'd become allergic to penicillin. The doctor told me, "Don't ever take penicillin again. It might kill you." You know, and, you know, it's a funny thing. I've never had any trouble with that. Never had a bit of trouble. If there was Penicillin Anonymous, I'd have about 35 years right now. Never had the compulsion to take any at all, you know. But all of a sudden, I just became allergic to the stuff. I took it successfully several times. I don't think it makes a damn bit of difference. My wife's an alcoholic. She thinks it from the first day. I think I drank myself into alcoholism, and it don't make any difference. We're both alcoholics. But then a typical day, once she moved in, a typical day then was I'd wake up late and get down to the office and go next door to the bar and get home about 2 or 2:30, and I'd put my pajamas on. I'd sit on the edge of the bed and plan my future and start drinking that vodka and playing those old 78 records. And here comes my son.
Please turn to side 2 of this cassette to continue the program.
My future, and start drinking that vodka and playing those old 78 records. And here comes my son. And it's like 2:30 in the afternoon. And he'd come home and I'd say, I don't know who you think you're kidding. It's only 2:30 in the afternoon and school don't even get out till 3. And you're already home by 2:30. You know, you've ditched class or you've ditched all day as far as I know. You know. And I'd stand up there and with my pajamas on with a bottle of vodka in my hand and I'd ask him, how the hell do you ever expect to amount to anything? You know, if you don't apply yourself in this world, my son, you haven't got a chance. You need a diploma to get any kind of a job. I'm really worried about you. And he'd look at me funny. He always had 3 or 4 guys with him, and they all looked at me funny. And they were surfers, and they kept their surfboards down there. You know, it was something else we had to trip over. And he'd go off surfing with his friends, and I could fantasize a little while longer. And then here comes my wife home from work. And, you know, I'm kind of a grouchy guy if I'm not drinking. I just don't sit in the corner and read a book or watch TV or something. I'm not very sociable. And you're free to do anything you want. Just don't bother me. Don't ask me my opinion. Don't ask me for any money. You're free to do any damn thing you want to do, you know. But you give me one drink and all that changes. And I don't care who you are. You're the most interesting person I have ever met in my entire life. And, you know, I want to sit with you. I want to hear your whole life story. I'm prepared to sit up all night with you as long as we got booze and hear your plans for the future. I'm right with you as long as we got booze. My wife, on the other hand, is a very friendly, outgoing person. She knows the paper boy by his name. She knows the girls at the supermarket, you know, the checkout gal. She knows their name, not only their name, she knows all their kids' names and their husbands' names. And I don't know how she gets all that information, but she sure does. And I could go to the same store for 20 years and they'd never know me in there, you know. But she knows everybody in the neighborhood and, you know, and they all know her. But you give her one drink and all that changes. All the pent-up emotions and hostilities of a lifetime come out in that first drink. And, folks, she just gets meaner than hell. Some people should not drink, you know. And, you know, I was so damn glad to see her. You know, I love everybody when I'm drinking, but especially my family. God, I love them. And sickening, you know. I love them so much. But she came home and we'd have our first drink of the day together. And I'd try to get cozy, you know, and she'd take that drink and it'd just change her personality, you know. And she'd start getting standoffish and I'd try to get cozy and, you know, it'd never work. We could never drink together. We used to just pass each other in the night. And we'd end up fighting and having an argument and she'd break my old 78 records and just because I played them more than once, you know. I played these same records and heard these same songs from the time I was 18, you know, for about 30 years playing the same songs. But I hadn't heard it for a week or something, and I'd play one. My God, that's a good song. And I'd play it again. And then again and again and again and again. And sometimes I'd just get hung up on one little trumpet toot. I'd get the needle, you know, and just drop it in there. Just so I could hear it one more time, you know. And she'd go crazy. And she'd go over that phonograph and break the damn record, you know. And I'd say, my God, those are priceless 78s. You can't replace those, you know. Good, I never have to hear that again. And she went over to the machine one time, the turntable, and just took the arm and just bent it up. And I couldn't play any more records that night, I'll tell you. Next morning, I got a pipe wrench and a hammer and pliers. I tried to straighten that damn arm out. I couldn't. A metal arm. I don't know where she got her strength from. I couldn't move. I couldn't budge it. It cost $35 to get it fixed. And that was the kind of drinking we were doing. You know. So one time I told her, you know, this isn't working out at all. You know, you've moved in here, but it's just not working out, and I let you kick me out of all those other houses. But I moved here first. Therefore, you go this time. We're not married, remember? You divorced me. So you go this time. And so I'm going to go to my brother's house tonight. And when I come back tomorrow morning, I expect you gone. And so while I was gone to my brother's house, why, she decided to commit suicide again. She was always committing suicide. This is, you know, she was suicidal. In fact, after she was sober a couple of years, she was still suicidal. You know, things were happening, and something serious happened one day, I know that, and she was going to commit suicide, and then she remembered that she was the cookie lady at the meeting, and she, so she, you know, she had to postpone it again. But this time, she decided to commit suicide. And, you know, when she drank in a blackout. She'd take one drink and blackout. And so before she was going to kill herself, she went into the closet where my clothes were hanging and took a knife and just slashed and stabbed all my clothes and just ripped them all to hell, you know. And even took the knife and stabbed my shoes. And just ruined everything. It just made a complete shambles out of it. And just went berserk in that closet. And then she took the rags that she had made and put them around the doors and the windows. Try to make the place airtight. And turned the gas on in the kitchen oven. And went to bed. And the next morning she woke up. Nothing happened. Nothing did happen. You know, that old place we lived in was a half a block from the water, and the wind used to whistle through those boards. You could have turned the gas on 10 ovens and never smelled it. So she failed again. You know. And she looked at the mess she had made, you know, this place of this clothes all over, and she couldn't believe it. And then I got home, and I'll tell you, I couldn't believe it either. And then my son came home, and he looked around, he thought we were moving again. And there we were, you know. And, you know, that was our bottom, I guess. I had several bottoms. I don't know if that was my bottom or not. I had a bottom all the time, and I've had 1,000 moments of truth, and I still didn't quit drinking. And you know, I'm from a good family. She's from a good family. We had some pretty good plans when we got married. We were going to do some pretty damn good things. And here we were, you know. We had just drank every bit of goodness out of our lives. And from then on, it was bad all the time. It just got worse every day, you know. And I had been to a meeting, an AA meeting, one time. It was one of these meetings where the leader says, they give tokens. I don't know if they do that up here or not, but the leader says, anyone just completed their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get one of these poker chips. It says 30 days, and on the other side, easy does it. And it's a little token of their 30 days of sobriety. And so anyone just completed the first 30 days, so here comes this guy tearing up. And my name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. You know, the best 30 days I've ever had in my entire life, and I know that this is a spiritual program. I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and I just love every single person here, you know, and it's a wonderful, glorious way of life. And just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my boss, and they've made me general manager down at the plant. And I just love AA, and I love everybody here, and God bless every one of you. And sat down, and I thought, oh, God, yeah. And anyone else just finished their first 30 days? And here comes this lady. My name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very proud to get this chip. And I just want to tell you folks that this is a spiritual program, that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. I just love every single one of you here. And my children, when I see my children now, they look at me with respect in their eyes. And my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. And What a glorious way of life this is. And I just, for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We all love you so much. And she sat down and I thought, oh, God. Yeah. And I never went back. That's it. Yeah. And my wife and I had started back to group therapy. And we had gone to group therapy off and on for about 15 years, trying to figure out what the hell was wrong. And this therapist asked me, do you really drink as much as she says you do? You know, and I said, hell yes, I do. I drink a lot. Who wouldn't? Married to a woman like that. Yeah. And rotten kids. I got two of the worst kids I ever could imagine. I got this pressure job. My God, the pressure's going to kill me on that job. And so I drink. You know, I have a few drinks in the evening. What's the big deal anyhow? You know? And he said, have you ever thought of quitting? And I said, you know, as a matter of fact, I have. And I had. Every night I thought about it. You know? Sorry, tomorrow, not tonight. Tomorrow morning. You know? And he said, ever thought of joining AA? And I said, thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA, thank you. You know, and it's some kind of a spiritual program or something, you know. So I think it's a religious cult, is what I'm thinking. All I know is it's not for me. You know, that's okay for them, but it's not for me. And he says, I said, but I read about some stuff called anabuse. I think I'll get a hold of some of that. And so he put me in touch with a doctor. And I call the doctor's office, and the receptionist says, don't drink for 48 hours prior to coming on your appointment, and because you can't put that stuff in your system, you know. And so I didn't drink for 48 hours, and I went to my doctor's appointment. And I said, I'm here to get antabuse. Oh, yes. And the doctor will see you in a moment. And he checked my heart and my blood pressure and everything. He called me into his office, you know, and he closed the door. And I thought, oh, God, you know. And he went into this lecture on alcoholism. And he started talking about people that have the disease of alcoholism. You know, they have trouble coping with their problems and character defects. Instead of coping with their problems, they get drunk tonight instead. And then they wake up the next morning and they got a hangover and they still got all their problems. And it's a vicious circle, and it falls for years until they finally die or get killed or something. And he just went on and on and on about it. And he pulled a book out of his shelf, a bookshelf, and he started reading how people try to enjoy and control their drinking by switching from scotch to brandy and stuff. I know now what he did is he read a portion of chapter 3 to me. And he wouldn't stop, you know. And I couldn't get him to stop, you know. And I didn't want to hear that stuff, you know. And he said, you know, if you haven't drank for 48 hours prior to coming to this appointment, you don't need antabuse. You know, you need never take another drink as long as you live. God, I wanted to quit, but my God, that's a long time, you know. I just wanted to prove something. And he wouldn't stop. And finally... I says, well, Doc, if you're not going to give me antabuse, then I guess I better go. How much do I owe you? And he said, I can see I'm not making an impression on you at all. And he said, I want to tell you something I wouldn't tell most of my patients, but due to the nature of your appointment here today, I'm going to tell you. He said, I happen to know a little bit about alcoholism. You see, my wife's an alcoholic. And we've tried everything known to medical science. We've tried rest homes and sanitariums and psychiatry and abuse and the whole shot. We've tried everything. And nothing's worked for her. But she's sober right now. She goes to AA. And that's what I recommend that you do. Promise me one thing. Promise me that you'll go to the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, and there'll be no charge for this call. And that's about the only thing that guy said that day that impressed me at all. And I went up to and bought the book, and I threw it on my dresser. And then we had this fiasco where my wife slashed my clothes. And she had been with me and heard all that stuff that the doctor said. So she went back and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know for sure, but why didn't she go to some meetings with his wife? She'd be happy to take her. And so she came home that day, and, And she says, I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous with the doctor's wife. And I said, my God, what now? You know, there's always something with you, you know. I agree that you shouldn't drink. Some of us can and some of us can't, you know. Yeah. But, God, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, besides, what makes you think that the doctor's wife is going to drive down from Palos Verdes in her Cadillac and pick you up in this dump we live in? He says, well, I spoke with her this afternoon, and she said she'd come by about 7:45. She's not coming in. She's just going to toot the horn, and I'm supposed to come out and about 7:45, you know. And so I said, well, just remember what the name of the organization is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. Anonymous means no names. Don't give them my name, whatever you do. We're not married. You don't have a husband, remember? And I don't want anybody knocking on my door. Give it, you know. And so I said, but this I got to see. And so finally, about 7:45, this Cadillac drove up in front of this dump we lived in and tooted the horn, and off she went. And the first thing they told my wife in AA was that it was not her fault that I drank. You know, they could have started her off with something entirely different than that. And I just about had her convinced that it was her fault. But they said, no, you know, not your fault that he drank. Don't carry that guilt around with you, you know. You can't make anybody drink if they don't want to drink. And don't carry that guilt. It's not your fault that he drinks. You know, not your fault that anybody drinks. We just don't have that kind of power over anybody. And we also, you can't make him quit either. We just don't have that power over anybody. We can make anybody quit drinking. So don't pour his booze down the sink. He'll just go buy another bottle. And just, you know, if you think you've got a problem with alcohol, maybe you better come to these meetings and work on your problem and just let that SOB drink himself to death. If that's what he wants to do, it's his life, you know. She kind of liked the ring of that. So she kept going to these meetings, you know. And to be a good guy, I'd go to a meeting with her every once in a while, and I enjoyed the speaker meeting. Some of those guys were really good talkers, and I thought, God, they're funny, and they had all the wisdom in the world, and I would have liked to have met with them. I wonder where they drank. You know, I'd like to meet them in a bar and discuss this situation, you know. But most of the meetings we went to were the kind of meetings, you know, like there's 10 or 12 people sitting around a table, and the first guy tells a lie, and then the next, the rest is try to top that lie, you know. And it seemed like those same two people were at every meeting I went to, you know. My name's Joe Glow, and I'm an alcoholic, and I found a spiritual way of life here, you know, when I walk through the doors of AA and walk through with God. And what a glorious way of life this is, and it's the lights in the eyes of the people that turn me on and keep me coming back to these men. I just love every single person here, and you know, I've just got word that I've been made a full partner down at the plant. I'm taking delivery on my Mercedes in the morning. What a glorious way of life this is, you know. And God. And then by now, Mary Smith is so spiritual. She's got a halo. She's, you know. And my name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I walked hand in hand with God through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that turn me on, keep me coming back to these men. I just love everybody here, and I want to make a report here tonight that, you know, just a few short months ago, my children were failing in school, and now we're getting letters from all the major universities throughout the United States offering scholarships. And I'm also proud to stand up here tonight and tell you that my husband and I are a couple once again. What a glorious way of life. God, I couldn't. And then we all stood up and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And how hokey can you get? I hated it. I hated it, you know. And I finally told my wife, that's it. I've gone to my last AA meeting. I can't stand it, you know. And I said, but I am going to quit drinking. I know I'm an alcoholic. You know, I've got that word. You know, I realize that I am. So I'm going to quit. And I did. I quit drinking a little bit before Thanksgiving. And I didn't drink clear through Christmas, you know. And I bought presents and everything. and I'm sure I wasn't the most pleasant person to be around, but by God, I was sober, and drank, and Saturday night after Christmas, my wife went to a meeting, and I stayed home, and took a little inventory of myself, you know, and I said to myself, you know, you haven't drank before Thanksgiving, clear through Christmas, that proves you're not really an alcoholic after all. So I went to the liquor store and bought a half a pint of vodka. And I no sooner got it back to your place and I drank it. And I said, what the hell did I buy a half pint for? I went and got a fifth. Went and got another fifth. And I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday. And I closed the bar up at 2 a.m. And I woke up the next morning, 10 o'clock. And, geez, I'm already an hour late to work. And I threw my clothes on real fast and shaved and got in that car, you know. I knew by the time I got there I'd be fired, but I got there. And I had this awful hangover. My God, I had a hangover. You know, I didn't drink for over a month, and I poured all that alcohol into my system. I was sick. And so I went over to the bar a little early that day, and I ordered a glass of medicine. You know, that's a Bloody Mary. You know, it's not really a drink at all. It's just medicine. It's what it is. And I ordered a glass, and the bartender got a big, tall glass, and he put ice in it, and he put a shot of vodka and tomato juice and Tabasco and Worcestershire sauce and squeezed a lime and put some salt and stirred it, and I thought you'd never get the damn thing. And he finally got it, you know, and I drank it straight down, and I slurped it all over myself. Nuts. And I said, make me another one. And I went to the restroom and cleaned up and came back to the bar, and he said, did you want another Bloody Mary or did you want a martini? And I said, I'll just skip it. And I went over to the coffee shop section of this bar, and I had a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I haven't had a drink since. You know, and of all days to quit drinking, I hadn't even thought about it the night before. And you know, I didn't know that was my last drink. So far, it has been my last drink. And, you know, I've often thought, if I'd have known that that was going to be my last drink, I sure as hell wouldn't have had a Bloody Mary. I'd have had something of like a brandy snifter, you know, a fancy glass, or a martini or something, you know, in a fancy glass. And I'd have drank it, and then I could have thrown it down. Broke the glass and stomped out of the bar, you know, triumphant over alcohol. But I didn't know that was my last drink. And a couple of weeks went by. And before I realized that I hadn't had a drink in a couple of weeks, you know, and then anger set in, you know, and I had just completed 30 years of drinking, and I got this rotten wife, and I got two of the worst kids you could possibly imagine, a pressure job, and God, I owe money to everybody, it's all past due, and every time the phone rings, I jump clear across the room, it's a bill collector, and someone knocks on the door, I know it's the police, I don't know what I've done, but I know I'm guilty, I'm ready, you know, and now I can't even drink, now they've taken that away from me too, you know, what the hell am I going to do the rest of my life? You know, nothing. That's what I'm going to do. There's nothing to do if you don't drink. What the hell can you do? You can't go to a decent restaurant ever again. What's the first thing they ask you when you go into a nice restaurant? Would you like a cocktail before dinner? And you can't say to them, you know, well, yeah, I'd like one, but you see, I've got this disease. And it's of a twofold nature, you know. It's an allergy of the body, and it's coupled with an obsession of the mind. And if I even take one drink, I can't predict my behavior. If it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one. I used to think you had to explain all that stuff. In fact, I'd spend a good portion of my day explaining things to people that didn't want to hear the explanation, you know. If I was standing on the street corner and somebody walked up, I'd start explaining what I was doing there. I just had that need for people to know, you know. I just thought I was going to be stuck at Denny's for the rest of my life. And what a horrible thought. But you know, it's a funny thing. Everything that I knew for sure has turned out to be wrong. For instance, I went to a nice restaurant just recently, and the waitress came up and said, "Would you like a cocktail before dinner?" And I said, "No, thanks." And you know what? Didn't even phase her. Yeah. She just went to the next table and asked them, and they did, and they always do, always check, and they always do. I'm the only guy in the whole place not drinking, you know. And, it's all right. I've had my share, I guess, you know. But the cruelest thing that I've learned in my entire life is that they don't give a damn if you drink or not out there. That was one of the drawbacks of joining AA. Yeah. What are they going to say when they find out that I don't drink? Yeah. Well, I'm here to tell you, folks, they don't give a damn if you drink. You know, they don't care. And I think, you know, if they had any feelings about it one way or the other, it'd be okay. But they're just, their indifference bothers me, you know. No one gives a damn if you drink or not. That's a cruel, hard fact. And so I'll try to bring you up to date. I tried to work these steps, and the best I can. You know, I'm not a very sincere person, but you know, I worked these steps. So I belong to this big group in Los Angeles, and we were always comparing, you know, guys sober about the same length of time, and they'd say, "What step are you on?" And I'd say, "What step are you on?" And they'd say, "I'm on step two," or "I'm on step three." I always try to keep one step ahead of them. And somehow I've worked all these steps, and you know, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, just as if I'd have been sincere in the first place. It doesn't seem to matter, you know. You take the steps and it works anyway. And I've tried to refine my program since then. And you know, I've met a lot of people in my courses in AA here, you know, and I met a lot of people today, and I've met old ones and young ones and short ones and tall ones, and you know, I've got all kinds of problems, you know, that are unsolved, and I've got a lot of anger in me. But you know, I wouldn't trade places with one of those people that I met today. You know, I'll keep my problems, thank you. I'd rather have mine than yours, you know. I'd rather be who I am than you. And then no me down or anything, but I'll just take who I am, thank you. And that's one of the things that 14 years ago, I would have traded with anybody, you know. But I'll take who I am today. And, you know, it's a funny thing. I'm sober longer than my wife. How could that possibly be? She went to AA before me. How can that be? You know, well, she didn't hear the part about the pills. You know, and where we come from, you're not sober if you're taking pills and smoking funny cigarettes either. And so... So I took my last drink, I hope, on December the 29th, 1969, and she flushed her pills down the toilet on January the 1st, 1970. And if you'll notice, there's a whole year difference. I've got seniority in my house. If I say coffee, she's got to go and get it because she's the newcomer in the family, and that's it, you know. Part of the reason my son was looking at me so funny back in those days was that he was stoned out of his gourd, it turns out. And I'll be damned if he didn't have a problem with alcohol and pills and LSD and all kinds of stuff. And he turned himself into AA when he was 21 years old, and next May he'll be taking an 11-year cake. Our daughter is in Al-Anon, and we're an AA family. And you know, we weren't any kind of a family 14 years ago. And I don't want to intimate that we're the best family on the block, because we're sure not. You know, we've all got a lot of problems. But at least we've all got programs if we choose to work them. You know, And now if they would just work them the way I want them, everything would be fine, you know. But they got their sponsors, and they read the book differently than I do, I'll tell you that. But at least they got a program. Seems, you know, I don't know where they read that stuff from. They say it's a big book, but... you know, it's really a pretty wonderful life, actually. My son, he's a pretty popular guy in AA. He spoke at the Palm Springs Roundup about 4 or 5 years ago. And he was the young people speaker there. And you know, the first time I ever seen him dressed up since he was grown. You know, he had a brand new suit on, nice looking shirt and tie, and had his hair styled, you know, and shoes and looking good and everything. He stood up at the podium there. You know, that's a big deal like this. I mean, there's 1,200, 2,000 people sitting out there in that audience. And he stood up at the podium and he said, "My name is Matt Johnson. I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "I also use drugs." And he said, "I'm the son of a drunken mother and a drunken father." My wife and I were sitting out in the audience. We looked at each other and we just burst into tears. We were just so damn proud. So it's time for me to close here. I wish I had some kind of a message to lay on you, but... I just drank a lot, and I don't drink anymore, you know, and that's it. And I'm trying to cope with life without drinking. But I can announce a couple of things, that when I see my children, they look at me with respect in their eyes. And I'm proud to stand up here tonight and say that my wife and I are a couple once again. And I'm kind of a slow learner, but, you know, I know now that I found God when I walked through the door. And, you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people that turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you very much.